Well, we were treated to a great exposition this morning, and I'm looking for more tonight, so give the Lord a hand for his servant, Brother Raymond, as he comes to talk to us about America the Beautiful.
It's good to be back with you. Thank you again, Brother Richard, Pastor, for this opportunity to come before you and share some of the things that I've learned and read from Dr. Carson's book, not only from the book, but through my years of experience and just seeing what's going on in the country today. I remember when I came back from overseas back in the mid-85, I related to you earlier how Lester Sumrall came visit our church and the prophecy he gave about the vision he had of what Satan had was intending to do to the country. And it's amazing as I look back and says, man, you know, that was truly a prophetic word. You know, we have come a long way. And what he thought was trash and junk coming from television today, now it's all over the place. He'd be, I guess, really appalled if he knew what was going on, you know, not only on television, but in the movies and on the internet and all these different things. So it's really a tremendous, should give everyone, you know, who have been around for a while, you know, the older you get, the more concerned you get about society and, you know, the environment that you're living in and how it's going to impact your family and your children and your grandchildren. We should all be concerned with those things. So somebody once asked me, you know, why are you so into politics? Well, politics is life, you know, and the older you get, you realize that when you have to work so many hours in the day and find out that part of that money is being taken. Not necessarily. I mean, there are things that we want to support our government. Government has its rightful place, and we want to continue to support that. But when government becomes overreaching and overbearing, there's a problem. You know, as I mentioned earlier today, also, we have gone far away from the founding principles. And the Constitution is only, it's 7 articles and 27 amendments. And the 7 articles, the first 3 deal with government and the role of government. And one of the things the Constitution says is that whatever is not delineated in the Constitution is reserved for the states and the people. So the role of government should be very specific. It should be very, very limited. But today, there is also a 4th branch of government that has grown throughout the years. It's the executive branch. It's the bureaucratic branch of government. It's unelected, faceless, nameless officials who dictate policies. And what's happening is our influence and effect on government has become less and less. We just had a tremendous election where I believe the people spoke. They didn't like the direction the country was going in. And surprisingly enough, people who lost the election says, hey, you know, this is a sign that the people is telling us they want us to work together. You know, that's totally opposite of what actually happened. And the funny thing about it is, you know, we're all standing, you know, how could they figure that? Where did they get this from? You know, so it's kind of discouraging. But, you know, the framers were inspired by God, and they took a lot of examples from past history, and they created a system to where they wanted to try and maintain the position of government. See, the states created the government, the federal government. The federal government didn't create the states. It was only after 13 colonies decided to get together and says, hey, we need a stronger bond. And in order to do that, we have to institute a system to where we can all be subject to, but yet keep that system limited. And one of the ways they done that was to create separation of powers between the 3 branches. We have a legislative branch, we have a judicial branch, and we have an executive branch. The legislative branch is actually the most powerful branch. It used to be anyway. They've abdicated a lot of their power and a lot of their authority, especially in the last several months. As we can see, the Constitution gives them the power of the purse to regulate policies that's being made if they don't agree with it, and they've given that away. They just voted in another $1 trillion budget that they didn't have to. They just, you know, weakly just gave into it. And part of the problem is that because government is centralizing, you have big business coming into government, and you have not only the politicians in there, but they're not listening to the people anymore because they're insulated from the people. One of the strengths of the Constitution was the power, the separation of powers. And I would venture to say that we are really on the verge of losing that, because now it's the legislative branch should write law. When you have a president and the executive says, well, I'm going to decree a certain thing, and nobody stands up to stop it, there's a problem there. You know, we've lost that. But there is an answer. The framers were very smart. They were very astute people. And they realized that, hey, at some point, we could deteriorate to tyranny. And that's basically where we're heading. Tyranny meaning that you don't have the right to pursue the things. You don't have the God-given inalienable rights that we all thought we have as declared in the in the Declaration of Independence. Like I mentioned earlier today, Dr. Larry Arm from Hillsdale, he's a professor that runs Hillsdale College. He said that the Constitution is the frame that supports the Declaration of Independence, which is the beautiful picture. He refers to it as golden apples, but say it's like the Mona Lisa. The Mona Lisa is pretty, but the frame that protects the Mona Lisa is just as important. So that's where we find ourselves today. But there is hope, like I had mentioned, and that hope is in the Constitution itself. See, the Constitution gives us a way out. When the federal government becomes too powerful, too overbearing, too centralized, in Article 5 of the Constitution, there are two ways we can make amendments to the Constitution. And let me read just a portion of that. Congress, whenever 2/3 of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution or on the application of the legislatures of 2/3 of the several states, shall call a convention for the purpose of proposing amendments, which in either case shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of the Constitution. So basically what they're saying there is, when we have a runaway Congress, and they're runaway because they're drunk with power, to be honest with you, they don't listen to us no more. They listen to their special interest groups, their lobbyists. So we can't get through to them. They are going to protect that. They're going to protect that power structure, even if it means allowing illegal aliens to come in the country and tell them it's okay to come here, because what they want to do is create a voting bloc. They want to create a dependency of people to look to them for their answer. And once they do that, they will solidify their power. Congress is not going to propose any amendments to change the way they have set things up right now. So if we wait for Congress to do that, it's not going to happen. Because the Constitution was designed with we the people in mind, and we have the authority, the framers gave us the second option in that Article 5 amendment process, and that is on the application for a convention for the purpose of proposing amendments through the state legislators. Now, the state legislates all over the country now are predominantly in the Republican-controlled hands, meaning most people have a view that the federal government should be limited and power should be reserved to the states and to the people. So that's the process I think that we're going to have to use. We're going to have to get involved in this process of proposing, calling for a convention to propose amendments to the Constitution. We have to limit the federal government. If we don't, they won't. Okay, so we need to get involved in that process. And that's a whole different venture, and we can discuss that. If anybody's interested, we can get into the details about that later on. We left off Chapter 7 earlier today, dealing with the runaway budget. And it was interesting. My wife had just looked on the internet. She came across an article real brief about our debt. And it says right here from Jim Paris, some guy that does business and things like that on the internet. And he says here, I had an interesting but frustrating discussion with a young person this week about the national debt. This is not just any 20-something, but someone about to graduate with a finance degree from one of the best business schools in the Southeast. I made a comment about how President Obama has added to the national debt. She immediately interrupted and insisted that Obama has not added anything to the national debt. She went on further to say that the president has reduced the national debt and that he is one of the first presidents to have ever done this in a long time. And of course, he was dumbfounded. He was like, well, how do you answer that? And basically, she doesn't understand what deficit spending is. And he went on to explain, and I'll just briefly summarize it, is if your deficit spending means that you're spending more than you already take in anyway. So if you spend $10,000 this year, more than what you earn, and next year you spend $8,000 more than what you earn, well, then you save $2,000. You know, but you still spent $8,000 more than you had coming in. So the debt is still growing. So that's the misconception that this young lady was on. And surprisingly enough, well, not surprisingly enough, unfortunately enough, too many people don't understand it, and that's how they see it. So chapter 8, learning from our mistakes. And in chapter 8 of the book, again, the issue of slavery was also covered. Dr. Carson had talked about how overcoming slavery was a monumental step forward in living out the creed, all men are created equal. Overcoming that mindset that enabled slavery to dehumanize our fellow human being has come a long way. And I just want to throw this in there because, unfortunately, we still have a tragedy going on in our nation today. Started back in 1971, and that's the tragedy of abortion. When you dehumanize somebody, then that gives you the right to do anything that you want to do with them. And I think this issue of abortion, we can probably relate it to what it was like to live during the time of slavery. You had people in the South who had slaves, but there were actually two classes of people in the South that had slaves. And I learned this by reading Frederick Douglass books. There was the more elite, the slave owners, you know, and then there was the not so elite or the, I guess, the trailer type people, you know, the rednecks type people who were actually the slave taskmasters, you know. So they were a different group of people. And he said when he got to the North, it was different. It wasn't like that. Even though people in the North still had their prejudices and things like that, you know, for the most part, even the wealthy people didn't have slaves. So he said that was something interesting. And today it's like that in our society. Fred Price had once said that slavery would not have existed but for the church. And at one point, I might have agreed with him, but I kind of disagree with him now, because when I look at the current environment, the only people that are really fighting against this abortion effort is the church. You know, now they might not be, you know, full gospel and, you know, people like us. They're Catholics for the most part, but they have did such a good job against this issue of abortion that the tide is actually turning. One of the things that's also helping is humanizing this thing that they used to call a fetus. You know, they didn't want to say it was a baby, you know, so they used a fetus. And now we have science to back it up. They're saying within a few weeks now you can have a heartbeat. You know, you can see through sonograms, you know, babies sucking their thumbs, and you can determine already what their sex is going to be. So that's another tragedy. And how will the future generations look at us, knowing that we have allowed this to happen? Over 57 million babies have not been born because of abortion back since 1971. And it was interesting because when I was young watching the news, and I always used to hear the issue of abortion, I didn't understand what they were talking about. What I found was that the news didn't really inform you. It didn't educate you. They just put stuff out there and, you know, nobody would explain, you know, fetuses and, you know, abortion and things like that. But once I finally figured it out, I thought it was a very simple question, you know. No, it's not right for a woman to kill her baby, you know. And I was only like 9 years old then, you know, so I couldn't see what the big controversy was, you know. So, you know, when we stand up to these things, you know, we got to do something. So that's another issue that I think is going to be a scourge on our society, you know, and we as a church have to continue to stand up against it. When our nation was rapidly rising to the pinnacle of the world, we were not ashamed of our relationship with God. In fact, reading from the Bible was not only common, it was expected in every public school. The framers wanted generally accepted religious values to be taught in our schools without favoring any particular denomination. but they never intended to exclude God from our classrooms because they knew that they would have to have something upon which to base your system of values. If only we believe in evolution and survival of the fittest, whose values do we use to govern our society? In chapter 9, America's role in the world at war. From the time of its inception until now, the United States have been involved in many military conflicts. By the early 1900s, people were beginning to be wary of war. But let's face the facts. You know, we live in an imperfect world, and for the most part, most despots, most dictators don't respect anything but strength and power. You know, and Ronald Reagan, you know, once said, you know, in order to maintain the peace, we have to have a strong standing army. And our military, I think, is always most effective and most efficient when they're given an assignment and given a task and it's not politicized. You know, every venture we've been in the military has went in there to do what they were supposed to do. They were able to do it. Just recently, the whole situation in Iraq and Afghanistan was successful until politics got involved in it. Now, because of politics, everything that men and women has died for, you know, young men went over to Iraq, risked their lives. Some of them lost their lives, lost their limbs. Now everything is being undone. And it's an absolute shame. It's an absolute shame. It hurts me to see all that effort, you know, and all that time just blown away by the whim of some politician, you know, who thinks for political expedience, you know, to undo everything that we've always done, you know, and it's difficult. I enjoyed the military, and I want to encourage all the young people, if you're looking for opportunities, you can't find a better opportunity than you can find in the military. The training is not like it used to be. You know, I went in and I studied aircraft mechanics. And then when I got out, I had to go through the FAA certification process. Now, if you go in, I don't care what your field of endeavor is, you're going to come out with an equivalent civilian certification. If you go in there to study computers, you're going to come out with whatever it is that they give you for a computer degree. You know, if you want to be a doctor, if you want to be a colorist, you know, a food, you know, specialist, you're going to come out rated for whatever that is. So there are tremendous opportunities there. But reluctantly, I have to say, with the current political environment and maybe in the future, I don't want you to go in there and your service be abused, you know, or taken granted for, or what you do not be considered, you know, because it is a very it can be a very tough life. You know, it's you know, you're required to make a lot of sacrifices. So it's sort of a dilemma that we're facing. And the thing that's different about the military here since, I guess, the 70s, when they took away the draft, is that everybody that goes in there volunteers for the military. And we are a smaller military than we've ever been, but we're well-trained and well-equipped, and we should continue to do that. And it's all with people who want to be there. You know, they're not forcing people to go in the military anymore. You're either going because you want to, you're going to try and better yourself. And when you do go in the military, you don't necessarily have to be employed in something that's going to put you in harm's way. There are plenty of other fields that you can get involved in that, you know, that can support those people on the front lines and still benefit yourself. So make that a consideration for all the young people who want to consider, you know, different avenues and opportunities. Hopefully, we can change the current political climate and continue to make the military a good place of opportunity, and only when it's absolute necessary for the safety and protection of America, then you should be put out on the front lines. In chapter 10, Dr. Carson talks about health care. Is health care a right? Well, first of all, let me say Obamacare is wrong, and it should be repealed. But again, we just had an election, and they promised us we're going to repeal Obamacare, and where are we now? You know, the law is how many pages? 1,200 pages or something like that? Yeah, 2,100. Nothing good can be in any law that's 2,100 pages. You know, The tax code, that's probably just as much because nobody can understand it. You know, it is absolutely ridiculous. So what are we going to do? You know, if they don't repeal it, then it's going to continue to grow. It's going to continue to get worse. They say it's going to implode on itself. But what does that mean? In the meantime, a lot of people are going to get hurt and a lot of people are going to suffer because of that. Our founding fathers felt that everyone had a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But does everyone have the right to health care? The Bible tells us that almost every time Jesus arrived in a new area, he first healed the sick. These acts has proved goodwill and credibility, making it much easier for him to talk about the weightier matters of life. Perhaps the lesson for us is to make sure that the basic needs of most people, of the most helpless among us, are taken care of. Maybe the real question is not whether health care should be available to everyone in our society, but rather, how can we provide universal health care in an efficient and cost-effective manner? Well, I think who better than people like Dr. Carson, who understand health care and who have experience in that field of endeavor, to tackle this issue and tackle this problem. We don't need politicians who are embedded in their ideology of how government should run and have no idea of, you know, of the practical matters and the practical things. I think, like Pastor mentioned earlier today, why go hire a CEO to run your company, your multi-million-dollar company, if he's never had an experience of running a business? We made the mistake and we fell for the illusion that someone had the answer because of their platitudes and you know, and us, for some of us, you know, projecting upon this person what we wanted to see. Dr. Carson has some very good ideas, and it was good because he delineated some of those ideas when he had on the prayer breakfast that he attended back in 2014. One of the things he suggests that we should do is have a health savings account from birth. And that will enable people to be responsible, because if you have to go and you have to spend your money that you have in this health savings account to make your decisions on what type of procedures you're going to get and different things like that, it's going to make you a better consumer. And isn't that what we do anyway? You know, don't we go out and compare, you know, do I want an iPhone or do I want an Android, you know, and you compare the features. And, you know, it depends on what you like. You know, not everybody has to have an iPhone 6, 5 or whatever. You know, it all depends on what you like. Why can't healthcare be the same way? You know, instead of the government saying, well, you got to have this and you got to have that. You know, why can't we make our own decisions? Another thing that he should suggest is that we have a two-tier system as long as it's adequate. Again, that goes to a two-tier system goes to what you're looking for. There's five-star hotels and there's, you know, like two and three-star hotels. What are you looking for? You know, sometimes you might want to go stay in a really nice hotel. Other times you might want to, you know, just have a place to sleep for the night. It all depends. And again, it puts back choice in the matter. Part of the problem that's happening in the healthcare industry now is the runaway medical fraud, because people are not responsible for what care they get take of. My wife works for an insurance company, and a lot of times, you know, people who go there are on, I guess, state Medicaid or something like that. So the doctors will prescribe procedures, and, you know, the patient doesn't know. They don't care. They just go. They know it's free. They go there, and the doctor takes care of them. Well, you know, a lot of times what happens is the doctors try to bill the insurance companies for more than what they have charged, or they try to bill the insurance companies before they have permission from the insurance companies to do a certain procedure. So what Dr. Carson is recommending is that, you know, for fraud, you take away the incentive for fraud and, you know, make some harsh penalties on the insurance companies and on the doctors who, you know, write these false insurance claims and different things like that. He also recommends that maybe government should be responsible for the catastrophic care of someone. I had a cousin, young man, brilliant, very industrious. Was out by himself on a job. He was a contractor working on a home, fell off a ladder, laid there several hours before it was found. Anybody found him, and basically is paralyzed now. You know, that's a catastrophic event. And, you know, his life has changed. You know, he's not going to be the same person anymore, and he's going dealing with some financial issues. So that would be something that I think might be good, just like FEMA. You know, FEMA is supposed to be there to help people in natural disasters when things are out and beyond their control. So those are some of the things that Dr. Carson recommends when it comes to health care. Chapter 11, A Nation Divided. I believe the recent upheaval in race relations in this country has been manufactured by people. This is my statement. Been manufactured by people that seek to destabilize our society. This is part of the transformation, the fundamental transformation that Barack Obama talked about in his 2008 election campaign. Also recently, and he had to dial it back a little bit, Giuliani, former mayor of New York City, said that he doesn't believe that Barack Obama loves this country. Who can you blame him, you know? But it wasn't a politically correct statement to say, but, you know, it's the truth. You know, if you look around and seeing all the policies and the things that this government has done, you know, you'd have to say that, you know, what's going on here? And to be honest with you, let's not just fault the president and his party. Let's also fault the Republicans, because they have not offered no resistance. They had not offered no there's no check as to what he's doing at all. They have willingly abdicated their responsibilities. You know, they have abdicated the power of the purse. They've abdicated the power to impeach. So now there's no restraint. And we have two more years left, you know. So we really have to be on guard. And I think the convention of states is the answer in the long run. Electing a conservative president definitely will help. But again, like I mentioned before, that there's a huge, humongous underground government called the bureaucracy. And, you know, they're people like the EPA, you know, the DEA, you know, the OAE, the EAE, the EEOC, you know. All of these people, you know, and the alphabet soup list can go on and on, you know. So we got to be careful. Over the last two decades, a great deal of progress have been made. And I agree with that statement. This is Dr. Carson speaking. During that time, many minorities have assumed important roles and very visible positions in our society and performed extremely well. Eliminating anxiety on the part of the majority about their capabilities. Today, you have to live fairly in a fairly sheltered life in a highly biased community to harbor the belief that someone is inferior simply because of the color of their skin. And it's not only the color of the skin, it's also your origin, where you're coming from. You know, we've come a long way. There are very successful people from India in our country today. There are very successful people from Vietnam in our country today. And I would venture to say a lot of them are here because they want to be here and because they can really, you know, reach their full potential. Unlike the division caused by racism, which seems to be shrinking in spite of what we see and hear in the media. And I believe that that's a true statement, you know, because the issue that that everybody was in uproar about most recently was the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson. And one of the reasons why I think it was so it was such big news, because it doesn't happen every day, you know, because in most of the inner cities, in Chicago particularly, And even in D.C., where we used to live, at one year, there were 8 murders in the span of a month in the D.C. area. You know, not in our neighborhood where we live, among young black men. You know, it wasn't no big deal outside of that area. You didn't hear about it because it happened all the time, unfortunately. You know, so when this one incident happened, I think it was there to drive a wedge between the American people. And unfortunately, too many people got caught up in that. And, you know, those feelings of past injustices were, you know, conjured up again, you know. So we do have to be careful of that. Christianity, Islam, and Judaism all sprang Christianity, Islam, and Judaism all sprang from the seed of Abraham, which might lead one to believe that the religion should have enough in common to peaceably coexist. Since the vast majority of each religion's constituents embrace the concept of peace, it is incumbent upon those who control their radical elements. They have to be confronted, the radical elements who advocate violence. This must be done both publicly and privately, and they have to use every means available to them to eliminate this cancer among them. And what he's talking about is the rise of radical Islam. The president himself won't even declare it as such, but that's what it is. There is an element of Islam that is, you know, that is contrary to what we believe. And they believe that if you don't, you know, submit to their authority, then, you know, you shouldn't exist. You know, we should get rid of you. So that's another big issue. That's another wedge, I think, that's being driven into society when we don't realize that there is definitely a threat there and need to be dealt with. And we've seen what happened in 9/11. We've seen what happened in Fort Hood. We need to be honest about it. There is a threat there. And we need to stand up to it and deal with it. And we're not, unfortunately. You know, we're giving more deference to the radical Islamists than we're giving to the nation of Israel. You know, how ridiculous is that? You know, it's absolutely ridiculous. You know, they're more in an uproar of the president, the prime minister of Israel coming here to give a speech in front of Congress than they are about, you know, the 21 Coptic Christians from Egypt that got their heads cut off. You know, it's amazing. It's amazing the time we live in. So those are one of the things that, you know, when we realize what's going on in the country, we can stand up to it and we can say something about it. Chapter 12, Liberty and Justice for All. All of our institutions that contribute to the civil society are under attack. Most recently, the police department across the country. All right? Dr. Carson says, I have great admiration for the police who risk their lives on a daily basis to protect our lives, our freedom, and our property. Remove all police protection from our society for just one day and imagine the mayhem that would ensue. Police provide far greater good than they do bad in our society. Our justice system may have plenty of opportunities to malfunction, but we should not give up on it and must continually, objectively evaluate potential improvements. And in spite of all the, in spite of all sorts of shortcoming, many people have benefited from the freedom and justice in our system of government and have went from rags to riches. These people would tell you that the only thing that they really asked for was a fair chance to work hard and provide for their own worth and benefit personally from their own efforts. Now, we stand in a place where when we stand and place our hands over the heart, over our heart, and before our country's flag and pledge with liberty and justice for all, we are simply saying that we want a nation that allows everyone to pursue their dreams. We should never underestimate the huge role that our justice system carries in creating fair play, allowing individuals to be successful in a large and complex society where, given half a chance, bullies will take advantage of anyone. Our justice system is based on the English system, which has long been recognized for its fairness. Integral to a fair justice system is the opportunity for the accused to present their case to an impartial judge or jury with an opportunity to appeal the judgment. Because there is a limited number of courts and personnel, our judicial system can somewhat become cumbersome and overbearing. But in general, it works, in spite of, you know, we don't get the outcome that we're looking for. Unfortunately, we have an overabundance of lawyers, all of whom need to make a living, and so we can expect to have excessive litigation in our society for a long time to come. And that is true. You heard this thing about tort reform, and basically that means trying to reform the legal system, because the way it stands now, anybody can bring a claim against anybody. And whether you win or lose, there's no, I guess, as Biden would say, no skin in the game, you know. So one of the things that maybe we could do, and Dr. Carson suggests, is that maybe we can have a loser pay system, Some people might say, well, that will prevent, you know, the people who are, you know, least able and capable of bringing an accusation against somebody. Maybe that will prevent them from bringing that. But I think evidence has shown that it's clear without something like that, then it just opens up an opportunity for anybody to bring any kind of charge. One of the things that is affecting the medical industry and affecting healthcare is the overabundance of malpractice suits. You know, these lawyers got to, I have a lawyer friend in D.C. He told me, man, he just skirted a $5 million lawsuit, you know, when he was practicing. So, you know, it's very the lawyers are out there and they need to make, you know, they need to make money. And maybe Dr. Carson also regulates, maybe we should limit the number of lawyers that we have, because just about anything now is all written legally. You know, that's why it becomes so complicated. One of the jokes I heard about lawyers is that a gang of robbers broke into a lawyer's club by mistake. The old legal lions gave them a fight for their life and their money. The gang was very happy to escape. And on the way out, one of the robbers said to the other one, hey, it ain't so bad. We got $25 between us. The other robber screamed, man, I warned you not to go into that lawyer's club. We had $100 before we went in there. That's what lawyers will do to you. A great deal of bureaucracy has been added to our government in order to control corruption. But what about the corruption in the government? How do we control that? You know, the answer lies with we the people. And as I had mentioned before, government will not reform itself. It's up to us outside the government through our state legislatures to now start making inroads to start changing that. And maybe to help save what we can of the union, which I believe we can, because it's obvious to me in the last couple of elections, in these two last midterms election, people are aware. They know what's going on. They don't like what's going on. And when we educate them on what they can do about it, we're going to see real structural long-term change. Every citizen of the United States should be expected to contribute to its welfare, which requires a fair system of taxation. We currently do not have such a system because our tax code is so complex and overburdensome. Just like this healthcare deal, you know, nobody understands the tax system. You know, what I do understand is that I'm paying more taxes now than I ever had before in my life. 7 years ago, I'll be honest with you, 7 years ago, I didn't used to owe the government, you know, and, you know, I've been owing the government for the last, what, 5-6 years, you know, and they are ruthless. You know, you don't pay them their money. Shoot, man, the interest that you have to pay on it, it's like paying them forever. So I'm really concerned. You know, our money says on it, in God we trust. So our taxation should be based on God's financial principle, but just a tenth. Why can't the government live off of a tenth? You know, we do a tremendous amount just off the tenth alone. And if you want to, I wouldn't. But, you know, you can give the government an additional above and beyond that. Me personally, I keep it for myself. I think I can make a better decision with it than they can. I'll give them a tenth so they can support the things that they are constitutionally authorized to do, defend and protect the country. You know, I'll give them a tenth so they can keep our military men well-clothed, well-trained, well-fed, and well-taken care of. I'll give them a tenth so they can build that wall on the southern border so they can stop people from just running over here. If the people want to come here, then, you know, we have a process. Let's go through the process. We'd love to have you, but go through the process. Don't come here and break our laws and then expect to be rewarded for it. Okay, chapter 13, what's good about America? Well, I got a hold of Dinesh D'Souza. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He made the video. He also has a book called America, What the World Would Be Like Without It. And I think his summation of what's good America was really, really concise. And because he's an immigrant himself, he's from India. And he came in, he had the opportunity to work in the Reagan administration as a young, you know, newly naturalized citizen in America. And he's really, really has some very good books, and he's a Christian person, you know, and he has a book about Christian apologetics. And again, I want to encourage our young people to start reading these books, reading information that, you know, that's going to prepare you for what you're going to have to deal with in the future when you go to colleges and when you start dealing in life in general. Maybe you can help some people who don't know by sharing that information with them. America is under attack as never before. This is Dinesh D'Souza writing here. Not only from terrorists, but also from people who provide a justification for terrorism. Islamic fundamentalists declare America is great Satan. Europeans rail against America. Capitalism and American culture. South American activists denounce the United States for neo-colonialism and oppression. Anti-Americanism from abroad would not be a problem if Americans were united in standing up for our own country. But in this country itself, there are those who blame America for most of the evils of the world. On the political left, many fault the United States for a history of slavery and for continuing inequality and racism. Even on the right, traditionally the home of patriotism, we hear influential figures say that America has become so decadent that we are slouching towards Gomorrah. Interesting point right here. When I read this right here, it took me back to when I had first got back from the States. I was from overseas. When I got back to the States, I went to San Diego for some training. And I was able to visit this one church. It was called Horizon Christian Center. And it was a beautiful place. They had, because San Diego is a very diverse culture. Just about everybody was there. We had Asians, there were black people, there were white people, and it was just a beautiful place. We were praising God, and, you know, it was just wonderful. But it was kind of weird because the pastor was doing a teaching on, Babylon. And who is this great Babylon, and where should the Antichrist rise from, and different things like that. And I didn't realize that at the time, and I didn't get to think about it until just recently when he was teaching that America was Babylon because of our society and because of, you know, the music and the television and the movies and different things like that. You know, I think that's unfortunate. I sort of have a different perspective about America's role in the world and our relation spiritually in the world. And I haven't quite been able to articulate it right now, but when I do, hopefully I'll be able to share that with you at some point. If these critics are right, then America should be destroyed. And who can dispute some of their particulars? This country did have a history of slavery and racism, and racism continues to exist. There is much in our culture that is vulgar and decadent. But the critics are wrong about America because they are missing the big picture. In their indignation over the sins of America, they ignore what is unique and good about American civilization. Mr. Dinesh D'Souza goes on to write, as an immigrant who has been chosen to become an American citizen, I feel especially qualified to say what is special about America. Having grown up in a different society, in my case, Bombay, India, I am not only able to identify aspects of America that are invisible to the natives, but I am accurately conscious of the daily blessing that I enjoy in America. Here then is my list of the 10 things that are great about America. America provides an amazing good life for the ordinary guy. Rich people live well everywhere, but what distinguishes America is that it provides an impressively high standard of living for the common man. We now live in a country where construction workers regularly pay $4 for a non-fat latte, where maids drive a nice car, and where plumbers take their families on vacations to Europe. Indeed, newcomers to the United States are struck by the amenities enjoyed by the poor people. This fact was dramatized in the 1980s when the CBS television broadcasted a documentary called People Like Us, intended to show the miseries of the poor during an ongoing recession. The Soviet Union also broadcasted the documentary with a view of embarrassing the Reagan administration. By the testimony of former Soviet Union leaders, it had an opposite effect. Ordinary people across the Soviet Union saw that the poorest Americans had television sets, microwaves, and they even owned cars. They arrived at the same perception that I witnessed as an acquaintance of mine from Bombay who was unsuccessfully trying to get to the United States. I asked him, why are you so eager to come to America? He replied, I really want to live in a country where the poor people are fat. America offers more opportunity and social mobility than any other country, including the countries of Europe. America is the only country that has created a population of self-made tycoons. Only in America could Pierre, I can't pronounce this guy's last name, but this guy was from Iran. His parents, his father was in the military or whatever. This is the guy who started eBay. And then there's another guy, I can't pronounce his name either, from India that he's talking about here. And he is a mover and shaker in the technology industry. And he goes on to say that admittedly tycoons are not typical, but no country has created a better ladder than America for people to ascend from modest circumstances to success. You know, and we see that all over. And again, Dr. Carson, I think, embodies that. Work and trade are respectable in America. Historically, most cultures have despised the merchant and the laborer, regarding the former as vile and corrupt and the latter as degraded and vulgar. Some cultures, such as the ancient Greece and medieval Islam, even held that it is better to acquire things through plunder than through trade or contract labor. But the American founders altered this moral hierarchy. They established a society in which the life of the businessman and the people who work for him would be a noble calling. In America, there is nothing vile or degraded about serving your customers either as CEO or as a waiter. The ordinary life of production and supporting a family is more highly valued in the United States than in any other country. America is the only country in the world where we call the waiter sir, as if he was a knight. America has achieved greater social equality than any other society. True, there are large inequities of income and wealth in America. In purely economic terms, Europe is more egalitarian, more equal. But Americans are socially more equal than any other people, and it is unaffected by economic disparities. Alex de Tocqueville noticed that the egalitarianism a century and a half ago, and it is, if anything, more prevalent today. For all his riches, Bill Gates could not approach the typical American and say, here's $100. I'll give you if you bend down and kiss my feet. Most likely, the person will tell Gates where he can go and put his $100. The American view is that the rich guy may have money, but he isn't any fundamentally better than anyone else. People live longer, fuller lives in America, although protests rally against the American version of technological capitalism at trade meetings around the world. In reality, the American system has given citizens many more years of life and the means to live more intensely and actively. In the 1900s, the life expectancy in America was around 50 years old. A lot of us wouldn't be here back in the 1950s, right? In 1900s. Today, it's almost 75. And, you know, we can look forward to more years if we, stand on God's word and claim those things. Advances in medicine and agriculture are mainly responsible for this change. This extension of lifespan means that more years to enjoy life, more free time to devote to good causes, and more occasions to do things with the grandchildren. In many countries, people who are old seem to have nothing to do. They just lie around and wait to die. In America, the old are increasingly more vigorous, and more people in their 70s pursue pleasures and their passions in life as never before. In most countries of the world, your fate and your family have been handed to you. In America, you determine your faith yourself, your fate. That means your direction, your course in life, and what you're going to accomplish. You determine that. It's not up to your parents to choose who you're going to marry. You know, well, in the other hand, in my case, I may have to reconsider that. But anyway, I'm going to trust that what we put in our young people, that they're going to make the right decisions, you know. But in America, that doesn't happen. We don't arrange marriages for you. Go out and make your own decisions. This notion of being an architect of your own identity is an incredibly powerful idea that is behind the worldwide appeal of America. Young people especially find irresistible the prospect of authoring the nature of their own lives. There's nothing greater that you can have to say, hey, you know, I want to do this. You don't have to become a doctor. You don't have to become an engineer. You don't have to become a scientist. You don't have to become a preacher if you don't want to in America. You know, you get to pursue what you want to do. America has gone further than any other society in establishing equality of rights. There is nothing distinctively American about slavery or bigotry. Slavery has existed in virtually every culture, and xenophobia, prejudice, and discriminations are worldwide phenomena. Western civilization is the only civilization to mount a principled campaign against slavery. No country extended more treasure and blood to rid of slavery than the United States. We haven't, in all the wars that this country has been involved in, World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War, the Korean War, Afghanistan, Iraq, still the total casualties still haven't amounted to the amount of people that died during the Civil War. That was a very brutal war, and it was fought. Don't let nobody tell you otherwise, young people, especially the professors at colleges. It was fought over the issue of slavery, you know. So when they tell you that America hadn't paid a price, they paid a grave price for slavery in this country to get it right. And took them another 100 years to overcome all the other injustices. And we continue to overcome the injustices. And part of the problem is when we leave it up to 9 men in robes to make the final decisions, and they don't have the final say. That's a fallacy. You know, we need to correct that, because they've been wrong in just about all the major issues of society, you know, all the way back from, you know, Plessy versus Ferguson, and all the way back to Roe versus Wade. They've been wrong. And what do we have to look at the consequences that we have to live with? You know, there's a whole generation of scientists and doctors and, you know, entertainers and inventors that I haven't been able to come forth because of this decision. Now, how did I get all off onto that? Let me get back. We're about ready to wrap things up here. While racism remains a problem, this country has made strenuous effort to eradicate discrimination, even to the extent of enacting policies that give legal preferences in university admissions, jobs, and government contracts to members of minority groups. Such policies remain controversial, but the point is that it is extremely unlikely that a racist society would have permitted such policies in the first place. And surely African Americans like Jesse Jackson are vastly better off living in America than he would, say, in Ethiopia or Somalia. Okay, chapter 14. Who do we believe, and in whom do we trust? And I'm going to end with this. And we can have that last video queued up, and we're going to end with the last video. Just give you a heads up. This is Dr. Carson writing in the final chapter of his book. I encourage everybody, if you haven't got it, to read it. Go ahead and get it and read it. It's very good, and he's a prolific author. He's written several books, and he just keeps coming out with stuff. His latest book is actually One Nation, And in that book, he talks about what we can do, you know, to help change America. He actually gives steps, you know, what the issues are and what we can do as individuals and citizens to help turn the tide of the country. And of course, if you don't already know, he's definitely a candidate for presidency. He hasn't announced it, but I believe he definitely will. And he has an organization called the RunBenRun.org that is galvanizing support for him wherever you go. You may not hear about him a whole lot in the media, but, you know, like I said, the bench for the next leader, the conservative leader, is very deep. We have a lot of great candidates out there right now, and he's just as good as anybody else. I believe it is time for us to stand up and to be counted. We can no longer be passive because the Judeo-Christian way of life in America is at stake. We need not be ashamed of our faith, and we certainly should not allow those who believe differently to change who we are in order to be politically correct. Yes, we should accept them with brotherly love as we have been taught, but we should never compromise our belief system. We do believe in God, and we do believe in the right of everyone to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We do believe in orderly government that facilitate these goals rather than impede them. It is time to set aside political correctness and replace it with bold values and principles that founded our nation and caused it to rise to the pinnacle of the world faster than any other nation in history. It is time to stop apologizing and to start leading, because the world is desperately in need of fair and ethical leadership. If the leader is not American, then where will it be? And where will they lead? It is my prayer, America, that God will continue to shed his grace upon thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. I pray that with these blessings, our past will be but a stepping stone to a bright future, and that our best days will truly lie ahead of us. America, the beautiful, a new beginning.
Sea to shine.
Pastor.